recognizable by the contents of his pockets. Notes were still legible, folded in a case he carried. Among these were the name of a banking house in New South Wales, where a sum of money was, and the designation of certain lands of considerable value. Both those heads of information were in a list that Magwitch, while in prison, gave to Mr. Jaggers, of the possessions he supposed I should inherit. His ignorance, poor fellow, at last served him. He never mistrusted but that my inheritance was quite safe, with Mr. Jaggers' aid. After 3 days' delay, during which the Crown prosecution stood over for the production of the witness from the prison ship, the witness came and completed the easy case. He was committed to take his trial at the next sessions, which would come on in a month. It was at this dark time of my life that Herbert returned home one evening, a good deal cast down, and said, "My dear Handel, I fear I shall soon have to leave you." His partner having prepared me for that, I was less surprised than he thought. "We shall lose a fine opportunity if I put off going to Cairo, and I'm very much afraid I must go, Handel, when you most need me." "Herbert, I shall always need you, because I shall always love you. But my need is no greater now than at another time." "You will be so lonely."
"I have not leisure to think of that," said I. "You know that I'm always with him to the full extent of the time allowed, and that I should be with him all day long, if I could. And when I come away from him, you know that my thoughts are with him."
The dreadful condition to which he was brought was so appalling to both of us that we could not refer to it in plainer words.
"My dear fellow," said Herbert, "let the near prospect of our separation, for it is very near, be my justification for troubling you about yourself. Have you thought of your future?"
"No, for I have been afraid to think of any future."
"But yours cannot be dismissed. Indeed, my dear, dear Handel, it must not be dismissed. I wish you would enter on it now, as far as a few friendly words go, with me."
"I will," said I.
"In this branch house of ours, Handel, we must have a—"
I saw that his delicacy was avoiding the right word. So I said, "A clerk."
"A clerk. And I hope it is not at all unlikely that he may expand, as a clerk of your acquaintance has expanded, into a partner. Now, Handel, in short, my dear boy, will you come to me?"
There was something charmingly cordial and engaging in the manner in which, after saying, "Now, Handel," as if it were the grave beginnings of a portentous business exordium, he had suddenly given up that tone, stretched out his honest hand, and spoken like a schoolboy.
"Clara and I have talked about it again and again," Herbert pursued, "and the dear little thing begged me only this evening, with tears in her eyes, to say to you that if you will live with us when we come together, she will do her best to make you happy, and to convince her husband's friend that he is her friend too. We should get on so well, Handel."
I thanked her heartily, and I thanked him heartily, but said I could not yet make sure of joining him as he so kindly offered. Firstly, my mind was too preoccupied to be able to take in the subject clearly. Secondly, there was a vague something lingering in my thoughts that will come out very near the end of this slight narrative. "But if you thought, Herbert, that you could, without doing any injury to your business, leave the question open for a little while—"
"For any while," cried Herbert. "6 months, a year."
"Not so long as that," said I. 2 or 3 months at most." Herbert was highly delighted when we shook hands on this arrangement, and said he could now take courage to tell me that he believed he must go away at the end of the week.
"And Clara?" said I. "The dear little thing," returned Herbert, "holds dutifully to her father as long as he lasts. But he won't last long. Mrs. Wimple confides to me that he is certainly going."
"Not to say an unfeeling thing," said I. "He cannot do better than go."
"I'm afraid that must be admitted," said Herbert. "And then I shall come back for the dear little thing, and the dear little thing and I will walk quietly into the nearest church. Remember, the blessed darling comes of no family, my dear Handel, and never looked into the red book, and hasn't a notion about her grandpapa. What a fortune for the son of my mother!"
On the Saturday in that same week,
I took my leave of Herbert, full of bright hope, but sad and sorry to leave me, as he sat on one of the seaport mail coaches. I went into a coffee house to write a little note to Clara, telling her he had gone off, sending his love to her over and over again, and then went to my lonely home, if it deserved the name, for it was now no home to me, and I had no home anywhere. On the stairs, I encountered Wemmick, who was coming down after an unsuccessful application of his knuckles to my door. I had not seen him alone since the disastrous issue of the attempted flight, and he had come in his private and personal capacity to say a few words of explanation in reference to that failure.
"The late Compeyson," said Wemmick, "had by little and little got at the bottom half of the regular business now transacted, and it was from the talk of some of his people in trouble, some of his people being always in trouble, that I heard what I did. I kept my ears open, seeming to have them shut, until I heard that he was absent, and I thought that would be the best time for making the attempt. I can only suppose now that it was part of his policy, as a very clever man, habitually to deceive his own instruments. You don't blame me, I hope, Mr. Pip. I'm sure I tried to serve you with all my heart."
"I am as sure of that, Wemmick, as you can be, and I thank you most earnestly for all your interest and friendship."
"Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a bad job," said Wemmick, scratching his head, "and I assure you I haven't been so cut up for a long time. What I look at is the sacrifice of so much portable property. Dear me.
What I think of, Wemmick, is the poor owner of the property."
"Yes, to be sure," said Wemmick. "Of course, there can be no objection to your being sorry for him, and I'd put down a £5 note myself to get him out of it. But what I look at is this. The late Compeyson, having been beforehand with him in intelligence of his return, and being so determined to bring him to book, I do not think he could have been saved. Whereas the portable property certainly could have been saved. That's the difference between the property and the owner, don't you see?"
I invited Wemmick to come upstairs and refresh himself with a glass of grog before walking to Woolworth. He accepted the invitation. While he was drinking his moderate allowance, he said, with nothing to lead up to it, and after having appeared rather fidgety,
"What do you think of my meaning to take a holiday on Monday, Mr. Pip?"
"Why, I suppose you have not done such a thing these 12 months."
"These 12 years, more likely," said Wemmick. "Yes, I'm going to take a holiday. More than that, I'm going to take a walk. More than that, I'm going to ask you to take a walk with me."
I was about to excuse myself as being but a bad companion just then, when Wemmick anticipated me.
"I know your engagements," said he, "and I know you are out of sorts, Mr. Pip, but if you could oblige me, I should take it as a kindness. It ain't a long walk, and it's an early one. I say it might occupy you, including breakfast on the walk, from 8 to 12. Couldn't you stretch a point and manage it?"
He had done so much for me at various times that this was very little to do for him. I said I could manage it, would manage it, and he was so very much pleased by my acquiescence that I was pleased too. At his particular request, I appointed to call for him at the castle at 8:30 on Monday morning, and so we parted for the time. Punctual to my appointment, I rang at the castle gate on the Monday morning and was received by Wemmick himself, who struck me as looking tighter than usual, and having a sleeker hat on. Within, there were 2 glasses of rum and milk prepared, and 2 biscuits. The aged must have been stirring with the lark, for glancing into the perspective of his bedroom, I observed that his bed was empty. When we had fortified ourselves with the rum and milk and biscuits, and were going out for the walk with that training preparation on us, I was considerably surprised to see Wemmick take up a fishing rod and put it over his shoulder.
"Why, we are not going fishing," said I.
No, returned Wemmick, "but I like to walk with one." I thought this odd. However, I said nothing, and we set off. We went towards Camberwell Green, and when we were thereabouts, Wemmick said suddenly, "Hello, here's a church." There was nothing very surprising in that, but again I was rather surprised when he said, as if he were animated by a brilliant idea, "Let's go in." We went in, Wemmick leaving his fishing rod in the porch, and looked all around. In the meantime, Wemmick was diving into his coat pockets and getting something out of paper there. "Hello," said he. "Here's a couple of pair of gloves. Let's put 'em on." As the gloves were white kid gloves, and as the post office was widened to its utmost extent, I now began to have my strong suspicions. They were strengthened into certainty when I beheld the aged enter at a side door, escorting a lady.
"Hello," said Wemmick. "Here's Miss Giffins. Let's have a wedding."
That discreet damsel was attired as usual, except that she was now engaged in substituting for her green kid gloves a pair of white. The aged was likewise occupied in preparing a similar sacrifice for the altar of Hymen. The old gentleman, however, experienced so much difficulty in getting his gloves on that Wemmick found it necessary to put him with his back against a pillar and then get behind the pillar himself and pull away at them, while I, for my part, held the old gentleman round the waist that he might present an equal and safe resistance. By dint of this ingenious scheme, his gloves were got on to perfection. The clerk and clergyman then appearing, we were ranged in order at those fatal rails. True to his notion of seeming to do it all without preparation, I heard Wemmick say to himself as he took something out of his waistcoat pocket before the service began,
"Hello, here's a ring."
I acted in the capacity of backer or best man to the bridegroom, while a little limp pew-opener in a soft bonnet like a baby's made a feint of being the bosom friend of Miss Skiffins. The responsibility of giving the lady away devolved upon the aged, which led to the clergyman's being unintentionally scandalized, and it happened thus. When he said, "Who giveth this woman to be married to this man?" the old gentleman, not in the least knowing what point of the ceremony we had arrived at, stood most amiably beaming at the Ten Commandments, upon which the clergyman said again, "Who giveth this woman to be married to this man?" The old gentleman, being still in a state of most estimable unconsciousness, the bridegroom cried out in his accustomed voice,
"Now, aged P, you know who giveth,"
to which the aged replied with great briskness, before saying that he gave.
"All right, John, all right, my boy."
And the clergyman came to so gloomy a pause upon it that I had doubts for the moment whether we should get completely married that day. It was completely done, however, and when we were going out of church, Wemmick took the cover off the font and put his white gloves in it and put the cover on again. Mrs. Wemmick, more heedful of the future, put her white gloves in her pocket and assumed her green.
"Now, Mr. Pip," said Wemmick, triumphantly shouldering the fishing rod as we came out, "let me ask you whether anybody would suppose this to be a wedding party."
Breakfast had been ordered at a pleasant little tavern a mile or so away upon the rising ground beyond the green, and there was a bagatelle board in the room in case we should desire to unbend our minds after the solemnity. It was pleasant to observe that Mrs. Wemmick no longer unwound Wemmick's arm when it adapted itself to her figure, but sat in a high-backed chair against the wall, like a violoncello in its case, and submitted to be embraced as that melodious instrument might have done. We had an excellent breakfast, and when anyone declined anything on table, Wemmick said,
"Provided by contract, you know. Don't be afraid of it."
I drank to the new couple, drank to the aged, drank to the castle, saluted the bride at parting, and made myself as agreeable as I could. Wemmick came down to the door with me, and I again shook hands with him and wished him joy.
"Thank ye," said Wemmick, rubbing his hands. "She's such a manager of fowls you have no idea. You shall have some eggs and judge for yourself. I say, Mr. Pip," calling me back and speaking low, "this is, altogether, a Woolworth sentiment, please."
"I understand. Not to be mentioned in Little Britain," said I. Wemmick nodded.
"After what you let out the other day, Mr. Jaggers may as well not know of it. he might think my brain was softening, or something of the kind.
Chapter 56. He lay in prison, very ill, during the whole interval between his committal for trial and the coming round of the sessions. He had broken two ribs. They had wounded one of his lungs, and he breathed with great pain and difficulty, which increased daily. It was a consequence of his hurt that he spoke so low as to be scarcely audible. Therefore, he spoke very little. But he was ever ready to listen to me, and it became the first duty of my life to say to him and read to him what I knew he ought to hear. Being far too ill to remain in the common prison, he was removed after the first day or so into the infirmary. This gave me opportunities of being with him that I could not otherwise have had, and but for his illness he would have been put in irons, for he was regarded as a determined prison-breaker, and I know not what else. Although I saw him every day, it was for only a short time. Hence the regularly recurring spaces of our separation were long enough to record on his face any slight changes that occurred in his physical state. I do not recollect that I once saw any change in it for the better. He wasted and became slowly weaker and worse, day by day, from the day when the prison door closed upon him. The kind of submission or resignation that he showed was that of a man who was tired out. I sometimes derived an impression, from his manner or from a whispered word or two which escaped him, that he pondered over the question whether he might have been a better man under better circumstances. But he never justified himself by a hint tending that way, or tried to bend the past out of its eternal shape. It happened on two or three occasions in my presence that his desperate reputation was alluded to by one or other of the people in attendance on him. A smile crossed his face then, and he turned his eyes on me with a trustful look, as if he were confident that I had seen some small redeeming touch in him, even so long ago as when I was a little child. As to all the rest, he was humble and contrite, and I never knew him complain. When the sessions came round, Mr. Jaggers caused an application to be made for the postponement of his trial until the following sessions. It was obviously made with the assurance that he could not live so long, and was refused. The trial came on at once, and when he was put to the bar, he was seated in a chair. No objection was made to my getting close to the dock on the outside of it, and holding the hand that he stretched forth to me. The trial was very short and very clear. Such things as could be said for him were said, how he had taken to industrious habits, and had thriven lawfully and reputably. But nothing could unsay the fact that he had returned, and was there in presence of the judge and jury. It was impossible to try him for that and do otherwise than find him guilty. At that time, it was the custom, as I learnt from my terrible experience of that sessions, to devote a concluding day to the passing of sentences, and to make a finishing effect with the sentence of death. But for the indelible picture that my remembrance now holds before me, I could scarcely believe, even as I write these words, that I saw 32 men and women put before the judge to receive that sentence together. Foremost among the 32 was he, seated that he might get breath enough to keep life in him. The whole scene starts out again in the vivid colours of the moment, down to the drops of April rain on the windows of the court, glittering in the rays of April sun. Penned in the dock, as I again stood outside it at the corner with his hand in mine, were the 32 men and women, some defiant, some stricken with terror, some sobbing and weeping, some covering their faces, some staring gloomily about. There had been shrieks from among the women convicts, but they had been stilled, and a hush had succeeded. The sheriffs, with their great chains and nosegays, other civic gewgaws and monsters, criers, ushers, a great gallery full of people, a large theatrical audience, looked on, as the 32 and the judge were solemnly confronted. Then the judge addressed them. Among the wretched creatures before him, whom he must single out for special address, was one who almost from his infancy had been an offender against the laws, who after repeated imprisonments and punishments had been at length sentenced to exile for a term of years, and who, under circumstances of great violence and daring, had made his escape and been re-sentenced to exile for life. That miserable man would seem for a time to have become convinced of his errors, when far removed from the scenes of his old offences, and to have lived a peaceable and honest life. But, in a fatal moment, yielding to those propensities and passions, the indulgence of which had so long rendered him a scourge to society, he had quitted his haven of rest and repentance, and had come back to the country where he was proscribed. Being here presently denounced, he had for a time succeeded in evading the officers of justice, but being at length seized while in the act of flight, he had resisted them, and had, he best knew whether by express design or in the blindness of his hardihood, caused the death of his denouncer, to whom his whole career was known. The appointed punishment for his return to the land that had cast him out being death, and his case being this aggravated case, he must prepare himself to die. The sun was striking in at the great windows of the court through the glittering drops of rain upon the glass, and it made a broad shaft of light between the 2:30 and the judge, linking both together, and perhaps reminding some among the audience how both were passing on with absolute equality to the greater judgment that knoweth all things and cannot err. Rising for a moment, a distinct speck of face in this way of light, the prisoner said,
"My lord, I have received my sentence of death from the Almighty, but I bow to yours,"
and sat down again. There was some hushing, and the judge went on with what he had to say to the rest. Then they were all formally doomed, and some of them were supported out, and some of them sauntered out with a haggard look of bravery, and a few nodded to the gallery, and two or three shook hands, and others went out chewing the fragments of herb they had taken from the sweet herbs lying about. He went last of all, because of having to be helped from his chair and to go very slowly, and he held my hand while all the others were removed, and while the audience got up, putting their dresses right as they might at church or elsewhere, and pointed down at this criminal or that, and most of all, at him and me. I earnestly hoped and prayed that he might die before the recorder's report was made, but in the dread of his lingering on, I began that night to write out a petition to the Home Secretary of State, setting forth my knowledge of him, and how it was that he had come back for my sake. I wrote it as fervently and pathetically as I could, and when I had finished it and sent it in, I wrote out other petitions to such men in authority as I hoped were the most merciful, and drew up one to the Crown itself. For several days and nights after he was sentenced, I took no rest, except when I fell asleep in my chair, but was wholly absorbed in these appeals. And after I had sent them in, I could not keep away from the places where they were, but felt as if they were more hopeful and less desperate when I was near them. In this unreasonable restlessness and pain of mind, I would roam the streets of an evening, wandering by those offices and houses where I had left the petitions. At the present hour, the weary western streets of London on a cold, dusty spring night, with their ranges of stern, shut-up mansions and their long rows of lamps, are melancholy to me from this association. The daily visits I could make him were shortened now, and he was more strictly kept. Seeing or fancying that I was suspected of an intention of carrying poison to him, I asked to be searched before I sat down at his bedside, and told the officer, who was always there, that I was willing to do anything that would assure him of the singleness of my designs. Nobody was hard with him or with me. There was duty to be done, and it was done, but not harshly. The officers always gave me the assurance that he was worse, and some other sick prisoners in the room, and some other prisoners who attended on them as sick nurses, malefactors but not incapable of kindness, God be thanked, always joined in the same report. As the days went on, I noticed more and more that he would lie placidly looking at the white ceiling, with an absence of light in his face, until some word of mine brightened it for an instant, and then it would subside again. Sometimes
He was almost or quite unable to speak. Then he would answer me with slight pressures on my hand, and I grew to understand his meaning very well. The number of days had risen to 10, when I saw a greater change in him than I had seen yet. His eyes were turned towards the door and lighted up as I entered.
"Dear boy,"
he said as I sat down by his bed,
"I thought you was late, but I knowed you couldn't be that."
"It is just the time," said I. "I waited for it at the gate."
"You always waits at the gate, don't you, dear boy?"
"Yes, not to lose a moment of the time."
"Thank ye, dear boy. Thank ye. God bless you. You've never deserted me, dear boy."
I pressed his hand in silence, for I could not forget that I had once meant to desert him.
"And what's the best of all," he said, "you've been more comfortable along o' me since I was under a dark cloud than when the sun shone. That's best of all."
He lay on his back, breathing with great difficulty. Do what he would, and love me though he did, the light left his face ever and again, and a film came over the placid look at the white ceiling. "Are you in much pain today?"
"I don't complain of none, dear boy."
"You never do complain." He had spoken his last words. He smiled, and I understood his touch to mean that he wished to lift my hand and lay it on his breast. I laid it there, and he smiled again and put both his hands upon it. The allotted time ran out while we were thus, but looking round I found the governor of the prisoner standing near me, and he whispered,
"You needn't go yet."
I thanked him gratefully and asked, "Might I speak to him, if he can hear me?" The governor stepped aside and beckoned the officer away. The change, though it was made without noise, drew back the film from the placid look at the white ceiling, and he looked most affectionately at me. "Dear Magwitch, I must tell you now at last. You understand what I say?" A gentle pressure on my hand. "You had a child once, whom you loved and lost." A stronger pressure on my hand. "She lived and found powerful friends. She is living now. She is a lady and very beautiful. And I love her." With a last faint effort, which would have been powerless but for my yielding to it and assisting it, he raised my hand to his lips. Then he gently let it sink upon his breast again, with his own hands lying on it. The placid look of the white ceiling came back and passed away, and his head dropped quietly on his breast. Mindful then of what we had read together, I thought of the two men who went up into the temple to pray, and I knew there were no better words that I could say beside his bed than, "O Lord, be merciful to him, a sinner." Chapter 57. Now that I was left wholly to myself, I gave notice of my intention to quit the chambers in the temple as soon as my tenancy could legally determine, and in the meanwhile to underlet them. At once I put bills up in the windows, for I was in debt and had scarcely any money, and began to be seriously alarmed by the state of my affairs. I ought rather to write that I should have been alarmed if I had had energy and concentration enough to help me to the clear perception of any truth beyond the fact that I was falling very ill. The late stress upon me had enabled me to put off illness, but not to put it away. I knew that it was coming on me now, and I knew very little else, and was even careless as to that. For a day or two I lay on the sofa, or on the floor, anywhere according as I happened to sink down, with a heavy head and aching limbs, and no purpose and no power. Then there came one night which appeared of great duration, and which teemed with anxiety and horror, and when in the morning I tried to sit up in my bed and think of it, I found I could not do so. Whether I really had been down in Garden Court in the dead of night, groping about for the boat that I supposed to be there, whether I had two or three times come to myself on the staircase with great terror, not knowing how I had got out of bed, whether I had found myself lighting the lamp, possessed by the idea that he was coming up the stairs and that the lights were blown out, whether I had been inexpressibly harassed by the distracted talking, laughing and groaning of someone, and had half suspected those sounds to be of my own making, whether there had been a closed iron furnace in a dark corner of the room, and a voice had called out over and over again that Miss Havisham was consuming within it. These were things that I tried to settle with myself and get in some order as I lay that morning on my bed. But the vapour of a lime kiln would come between me and them, disordering them all, and it was through the vapour at last that I saw two men looking at me.
"What do you want?"
I asked, starting.
"I don't know you."
"Well, sir,"
returned one of them, bending down and touching me on the shoulder,
"this is a matter that you'll soon arrange, I dare say, but you're arrested."
"What is the debt?"
£123.15. A jeweller's account, I think."
"What is to be done?"
"You had better come to my house," said the man. "I'll keep a very nice house."
I made some attempt to get up and dress myself. When I next attended to them, they were standing a little off from the bed, looking at me. I still lay there.
"You see my state," said I. "I would come with you if I could, but indeed I am quite unable. If you take me from here, I think I shall die by the way."
Perhaps they replied or argued the point, or tried to encourage me to believe that I was better than I thought. For as much as they hang in my memory by only this one slender thread, I don't know what they did, except that they forbore to remove me. That I had a fever and was avoided, that I suffered greatly, that I often lost my reason, that the time seemed interminable, that I confounded impossible existences with my own identity, that I was a brick in the house wall, and yet entreating to be released from the giddy place where the builders had set me, that I was a steel beam of a vast engine clashing and whirling over a gulf, and yet that I implored in my own person to have the engine stopped and my part in it hammered off, that I passed through these phases of disease, I know of my own remembrance, and did in some sort know at the time, that I sometimes struggled with real people in the belief that they were murderers, and that I would all at once comprehend that they meant to do me good, and would then sink exhausted in their arms and suffer them to lay me down. I also knew at the time. But above all, I knew that there was a constant tendency in all these people, who, when I was very ill, would present all kinds of extraordinary transformations of the human face, and would be much dilated in size. Above all, I say, I knew that there was an extraordinary tendency in all these people, sooner or later, to settle down into the likeness of Joe. After I had turned the worst point of my illness, I began to notice that while all its other features changed, the one consistent feature did not change. Whoever came about me still settled down into Joe. I opened my eyes in the night, and I saw in the great chair at the bedside, Joe. I opened my eyes in the day, and sitting on the window seat, smoking his pipe in the shaded open window, still I saw Joe. I asked for a cooling drink, and the dear hand that gave it to me was Joe's. I sank back on my pillow after drinking, and the face that looked so hopefully and tenderly upon me was the face of Joe. At last, one day I took courage and said, "Is it Joe?" And the dear old home voice answered, "Wet your hair, old chap."
"Oh, Joe, you break my heart. Look angry at me, Joe. Strike me, Joe. Tell me of my ingratitude. Don't be so good to me."
For Joe had actually laid his head down on the pillow at my side and put his arm round my neck in his joy that I knew him.
"Which, dear old Pip, old chap,"
said Joe.
"You and me was ever friends, and when you're well enough to go out for a ride, what larks!"
After which Joe withdrew to the window and stood with his back towards me, wiping his eyes. And as my extreme weakness prevented me from getting up and going to him, I lay there penitently whispering, "Oh, God bless him! Oh, God bless this gentle Christian man!" Joe's eyes were red when I next found him beside me, but I was holding his hand, and we both felt happy.
"How long, dear Joe?"
"Which you mean to say, Pip, how long have your illness lasted, dear old chap?"
"Yes, Joe."
"That's the end of May, Pip. Tomorrow is the 1st of June.
"And have you been here all the time, dear Joe?"
"Pretty nigh, old chap. For as I says to Betty, when the news of your being ill were brought by letter, which it were brought by the post, and being formerly single, he is now married, though underpaid for a deal of walking and shoe leather, but wealth were not an object on his part, and marriage were the great wish of his heart."
"It's so delightful to hear you, Joe. But I interrupt you in what you said to Biddy."
"Which it were," said Joe, "that how you might be amongst strangers, and that how you and me, having been ever friends, a visit at such a moment might not prove unacceptable, and Biddy, her word were, go to him, without loss of time."
"That," said Joe, summing up with his judicial air, "were the word of Biddy.
Go to him, Biddy say, without loss of time. In short, I shouldn't greatly deceive you," Joe added, after a little grave reflection, "if I represented to you that the word of that young woman were, without a minute's loss of time."
There Joe cut himself short, and informed me that I was to be talked to in great moderation, and that I was to take a little nourishment at stated frequent times, whether I felt inclined for it or not, and that I was to submit myself to all his orders. So I kissed his hand, and lay quiet, while he proceeded to indite a note to Biddy, with my love in it. Evidently, Biddy had taught Joe to write. As I lay in bed, looking at him, it made me, in my weak state, cry again with pleasure to see the pride with which he set about his letter. My bedstead, divested of its curtains, had been removed, with me upon it, into the sitting-room, as the airiest and largest, and the carpet had been taken away, and the room kept always fresh and wholesome night and day. At my own writing-table, pushed into a corner and cumbered with little bottles, Joe now sat down to his great work, first choosing a pen from the pen-tray as if it were a chest of large tools, and tucking up his sleeves as if he were going to wield a crowbar or sledge-hammer. It was necessary for Joe to hold on heavily to the table with his left elbow, and to get his right leg well out behind him before he could begin, and when he did begin, he made every downstroke so slowly that it might have been 6 feet long, while at every upstroke I could hear his pen splattering extensively. He had a curious idea that the inkstand was on the side of him where it was not, and constantly dipped his pen into space, and seemed quite satisfied with the result. Occasionally he was tripped up by some orthographical stumbling block, but on the whole he got on very well indeed, and when he had signed his name, and had removed a finishing blot from the paper to the crown of his head with his two forefingers, he got up and hovered about the table, trying the effect of his performance from various points of view as it lay there, with unbounded satisfaction. Not to make Joe uneasy by talking too much, even if I had been able to talk much, I deferred asking him about Miss Havisham until next day. He shook his head when I then asked him if she had recovered.
"Is she dead, Joe?"
"Why, you see, old chap,"
said Joe in a tone of remonstrance, and by way of getting at it by degrees,
"I wouldn't go so far as to say that, for that's a deal to say, but she ain't living, Joe."
"That's nigher where it is," said Joe. "She ain't living."
did she linger long, Joe? Arter you was took ill, pretty much about what you might call, if you was to put it, a week, said Joe,
still determined on my account to come at everything by degrees.
Dear Joe, have you heard what becomes of her property?
Well, old chap, says Joe, it do appear that she had settled the most of it, which I mean to say tied it up, on Miss Estella. But she had wrote out a little coddle show in her own hand a day or two afore the accident, leaving a cool 4,000 to Mr. Matthew Pocket. And why do you suppose, above all things, Pip, she left that cool 4,000 unto him?
Because of Pip's account of him, the said Matthew.
I'm told by Biddy that had the writing,
said Joe, repeating the legal term as if it did him infinite good.
Account of him, the said Matthew. And a cool 4,000, Pip.
I never discovered from whom Joe derived the conventional temperature of the £4,000, but it appeared to make the sum of money more to him, and he had a manifest relish in insisting on its being cool. This account gave me great joy, as it perfected the only good thing I had done. I asked Joe whether he had heard if any of the other relations had any legacies.
"Miss Sarah," said Joe, "she have £25 per annum for to buy pills on account of being bilious. Miss Georgiana, she have £20 down. Mrs. What's the name of them wild beasts with humps, old chap?"
"Camels?" said I, wondering why he could possibly want to know. Joe nodded.
"Mrs. Camels,"
by which I presently understood he meant Camilla,
"she have £5 for to buy rushlights to put her in spirits when she wake up in the night."
The accuracy of these recitals was sufficiently obvious to me to give me great confidence in Joe's information.
"And now," said Joe, "you ain't that strong yet, old chap, that you can take in more nor one additional shovelful today. Old Orlick, he's been a-bustin' open a dwelling-house."
"Whose?" said I.
"Not I grant you, but what his manners is given to blusterous," said Joe apologetically. "Still, an Englishman's house in his castle, and castles must not be busted, except when done in wartime. And whatsoever the failings on his part, he were a corn and seedsman in his art."
"Is it Pumblechook's house that has been broken into, then?"
"That's it, Pip," said Joe. "And they took his till, and they took his cash-box, and they drinked his wine, and they partook of his wittles, and they slapped his face, and they pulled his nose, and they tied him up to his bedpost, and then give him a dozen, and they stuffed his mouth full of flowering annuals to prevent his crying out. But he knowed Orlick, and Orlick's in the county jail."
By these approaches we arrived at unrestricted conversation. I was slow to gain strength, but I did slowly and surely become less weak, and Joe stayed with me, and I fancied I was little Pip again. For the tenderness of Joe was so beautifully proportioned to my need that I was like a child in his hands. He would sit and talk to me in the old confidence and with the old simplicity and in the old unassertive protecting way, so that I would half believe that all my life since the days of the old kitchen was one of the mental troubles of the fever that was gone. He did everything for me except the household work, for which he had engaged a very decent woman after paying off the laundress on her first arrival.
"Which I do assure you, Pip,"
he would often say in explanation of that liberty, "I found her atap in the spare bed, like a cask of beer, and drawing off the feathers in a bucket for sale, which she would have tapped yourn next and drawn it off with you a-laying on it, and was then a-carrying away the coals gradually in the soup tureen and vegetable dishes, and the wine and spirits in your Wellington boots." We looked forward to the day when I should go out for a ride, as we had once looked forward to the day of my apprenticeship. And when the day came, and an open carriage was got into the lane, Joe wrapped me up, took me in his arms, carried me down to it, and put me in, as if I were still the small, helpless creature to whom he had so abundantly given of the wealth of his great nature. And Joe got in beside me, and we drove away together into the country,
where the rich summer growth was already on the trees and on the grass, and sweet summer scents filled all the air. The day happened to be Sunday, and when I looked on the loveliness around me, and thought how it had grown and changed, and how the little wild flowers had been forming, and the voices of the birds had been strengthening by day and by night, under the sun and under the stars, while poor I lay burning and tossing on my bed, the mere remembrance of having burned and tossed there came like a check upon my peace. But when I heard the Sunday bells, and looked around a little more upon the outspread beauty, I felt that I was not nearly thankful enough, that I was too weak yet to be even that. And I laid my head on Joe's shoulder, as I had laid it long ago when he had taken me to the fair or where not, and it was too much for my young senses. More composure came to me after a while, and we talked as we used to talk, lying on the grass at the old battery. There was no change whatever in Joe. Exactly what he had been in my eyes then, he was in my eyes still. Just as simply faithful, just as simply right. When we got back again, and he lifted me out and carried me, so easily, across the court and up the stairs, I thought of that eventful Christmas day when he had carried me over the marshes. We had not yet made any allusion to my change of fortune, nor did I know how much of my late history he was acquainted with. I was so doubtful of myself now, and put so much trust in him, that I could not satisfy myself whether I ought to refer to it, when he did not. "Have you heard, Joe?" I asked him that evening, upon further consideration, as he smoked his pipe at the window, "who my patron was?"
"I heard," returned Joe, "as it was not Miss Havisham, old chap."
"Did you hear who it was, Joe?"
"Well, I heard as it were a person, what sent the person what give you the banknotes at the Jolly Bargeman, Pip."
"So it was."
"'Astonishing," said Joe, in the placidest way.
"Did you hear that he was dead, Joe?" I presently asked, with increasing diffidence.
"Which? Him as sent the banknotes, Pip?"
"Yes."
"I think," said Joe, after meditating a long time, and looking rather evasively at the window seat, "as I did hear tell that how he was something or another in a general way in that direction."
"Did you hear anything of his circumstances, Joe?"
"Not particular, Pip."
"If you would like to hear, Joe," I was beginning when Joe got up and came to my sofa.
"Looky here, old chap," said Joe, bending over me. "Ever the best of friends, ain't us, Pip?"
I was ashamed to answer him.
"Very good, then," said Joe, as if I had answered. "That's all right. That's agreed upon. Then why go into subjects, old chap, which is betwixt two such must be forever unnecessary? There's subjects enough as betwixt two such, without unnecessary ones. Lord, to think of your poor sister and her rampages. And don't you remember Tickler?"
"I do indeed, Joe."
"Looky here, old chap," said Joe, "I done what I could to keep you and Tickler in Sundays, but my power were not always fully equal to my inclinations, for when your poor sister had a mind to drop into you, it were not so much,"
said Joe, in his favourite argumentative way,
"that she dropped into me, too, for if I put myself in opposition to her, but that she dropped into you always heavier for it. I noticed that. It ain't a grab at a man's whisker, nor yet a shake or two of a man, to which your sister was quite welcome, that had put a man off from getting a little child out of punishment. But when that little child is dropped into, heavier, for that grab of whisker, or shaking, then that man naturally up and says to himself, 'Where is the good as you're a-doing? I grant you I see the harm,' says the man, 'but I don't see the good. I call upon you, sir, therefore, to point out the good.'"
"The man says," I observed, as Joe waited for me to speak.
"The man says," Joe assented. "Is he right, that man?"
"Dear Joe, he's always right."
"Well, old chap," said Joe, "then abide by your words. If he's always right, where in general he's more likely wrong, he's right when he says this. Supposing ever you kept any little matter to yourself,
when you was a little child. You kept it mostly because you knowed as J. Garger's power to part you and Tickler in sunders were not fully equal to his inclinations. Therefore, think no more of it as betwixt two such, and do not let us pass remarks upon unnecessary subjects. Betty gave herself a deal of trouble with me afore I left, for I am most awful dull, as I should view it in this light, and viewing it in this light, as I should support it. Both of which, said Joe, quite charmed with his logical arrangement, being done, now this to you, a true friend, say. Namely, you mustn't go a-overdoing on it, but you must have your supper and your wine and water, and you must put betwixt the sheets. The delicacy with which Joe dismissed this theme, and the sweet tact and kindness with which Biddy, who with her woman's wit had found me out so soon, had prepared him for it, made a deep impression on my mind. But whether Joe knew how poor I was, and how my great expectations had all dissolved like our own marsh mists before the sun, I could not understand. Another thing in Joe that I could not understand when it first began to develop itself, but which I soon arrived at a sorrowful comprehension of, was this. As I became stronger and better, Joe became a little less easy with me. In my weakness and entire dependence on him, the dear fellow had fallen into the old tone and called me by the old names, the dear old Pip old chap, that now were music in my ears. I too had fallen into the old ways, only happy and thankful that he let me. But imperceptibly, though I held by them fast, Joe's hold upon them began to slacken, and whereas I wondered at this at first, I soon began to understand that the cause of it was in me, and that the fault of it was all mine. Ah, had I given Joe no reason to doubt my constancy, and to think that in prosperity I should grow cold to him and cast him off? Had I given Joe's innocent heart no cause to feel instinctively that as I got stronger, his hold upon me would be weaker, and that he had better loosen it in time and let me go before I plucked myself away? It was on the third or fourth occasion of my going out, walking in the Temple Gardens, leaning on Joe's arm, that I saw this change in him very plainly. We had been sitting in the bright warm sunlight, looking at the river, and I chanced to say as we got up, "See, Joe, I can walk quite strongly. Now you shall see me walk back by myself." "Which do not overdo it, Pip," said Joe. "But I shall be happy for to see you able, sir." The last word grated on me. But how could I remonstrate? I walked no further than the gate of the gardens, and then pretended to be weaker than I was, and asked Joe for his arm. Joe gave it me, but was thoughtful. I, for my part, was thoughtful too. For how best to check this growing change in Joe was a great perplexity to my remorseful thoughts. That I was ashamed to tell him exactly how I was placed, and what I had come down to, I do not seek to conceal. But I hope my reluctance was not quite an unworthy one. He would want to help me out of his little savings, I knew, and I knew that he ought not to help me, and that I must not suffer him to do it. It was a thoughtful evening with both of us, but before we went to bed I had resolved that I would wait over tomorrow, tomorrow being Sunday, and would begin my new course with the new week. On Monday morning I would speak to Joe about this change. I would lay aside this last vestige of reserve. I would tell him what I had in my thoughts, that secondly not yet arrived at, and why I had not decided to go out to Herbert, and then the change would be conquered for ever. As I cleared, Joe cleared, and it seemed as though he had sympathetically arrived at a resolution too. We had a quiet day on the Sunday, and we rode out into the country and then walked in the fields. "I feel thankful that I've been ill, Joe," I said. "Dear old Pep, old chap, you're a'most come round, sir. It has been a memorable time for me, Joe." "Likewise for myself, sir," Joe returned. "We have had a time together, Joe, that I can never forget. There were days once, I know, that I did for a while forget, but I never shall forget these." "Pep," said Joe, appearing a little hurried and troubled. "There has been larks. And, dear sir, what have been betwixt us have been. At night, when I had gone to bed, Joe came into my room, as he had done all through my recovery. He asked me if I felt sure that I was as well as in the morning.
Yes, dear Joe, quite. And are always getting a stronger, old chap?
Yes, dear Joe, steadily.
Joe patted the coverlet on my shoulder with his great good hand, and said in what I thought a husky voice,
"Good night."
When I got up in the morning, refreshed and stronger yet, I was full of my resolution to tell Joe all, without delay. I would tell him before breakfast. I would dress at once and go to his room and surprise him, for it was the first day I had been up early. I went to his room, and he was not there. Not only was he not there, but his box was gone. I hurried then to the breakfast table, and on it found a letter. These were its brief contents.
"Not wishful to intrude, I have departed, for you are well again, dear Pip, and will do better without. Joe. P.S. Ever the best of friends."
Enclosed in the letter was a receipt for the debt and costs on which I had been arrested. Down to that moment I had vainly supposed that my creditor had withdrawn or suspended proceedings until I should be quite recovered. I had never dreamed of Joe's having paid the money. But Joe had paid it, and the receipt was in his name. What remained for me now but to follow him to the dear old forge, and there to have out my disclosure to him and my penitent remonstrance with him, and there to relieve my mind and heart of that reserved secondly, which had begun as a vague something lingering in my thoughts, and had formed into a settled purpose. The purpose was that I would go to Biddy, that I would show her how humbled and repentant I came back, that I would tell her how I had lost all I once hoped for, that I would remind her of our old confidences in my first unhappy time. Then I would say to her, "Biddy, I think you once liked me very well, when my errant heart, even while it strayed away from you, was quieter and better with you than it ever has been since. If you can like me only half as well once more, if you can take me with all my faults and disappointments on my head, if you can receive me like a forgiven child, and indeed I am a sorry Biddy, and have as much need of a hushing voice and soothing hand, I hope I am a little worthier of you than I was. Not much, but a little. And Biddy, it shall rest with you to say whether I shall work at the forge with Joe, or whether I shall try for any different occupation down in this country, or whether we shall go away to a distant place where an opportunity awaits me which I set aside when it was offered until I knew your answer. And now, dear Biddy, if you can tell me that you will go through the world with me, you will surely make it a better world for me, and me a better man for it, and I will try hard to make it a better world for you." Such was my purpose. After 3 days more of recovery, I went down to the old place to put it in execution. And how I sped in it is all I have left to tell. Chapter 58. The tidings of my high fortunes, having had a heavy fall, had got down to my native place and its neighbourhood before I got there. I found the Blue Boar in possession of the intelligence, and I found that it made a great change in the Boar's demeanour. Whereas the Boar had cultivated my good opinion with warm assiduity when I was coming into property, the Boar was exceedingly cool on the subject now that I was going out of property. It was evening when I arrived, much fatigued by the journey I had so often made so easily. The Boar could not put me into my usual bedroom, which was engaged, probably by someone who had expectations, and could only assign me a very indifferent chamber among the pigeons and post-chaises up the yard. But I had as sound a sleep in that lodging as in the most superior accommodation the Boar could have given me, and the quality of my dreams was about the same as in the best bedroom. Early in the morning, while my breakfast was getting ready, I strolled round by Satis House. There were printed bills on the gate and on bits of carpet hanging out of the windows, announcing a sale by auction of the household furniture and effects next week. The house itself was to be sold as old building materials and pulled down.
Lot 1 was marked in whitewashed knock-knee letters on the brew house. Lot 2 on that part of the main building which had been so long shut up. Other lots were marked off on other parts of the structure, and the ivy had been